All right, Alexander, we are here once again on the Duran with Mel Kay. Mel, it is great to have you on the Duran. And before we get started, where can people follow your work? And you also have a new book out as well.
Yes. TheMelKayShow.com is my hub. I also want to say about my book, I put my entire bibliography for the book, all the documents I used, which everyone can read for themselves, on TheMelKayShow.com resource page. And I also have a show Monday through Friday, 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern on Rumble and X Live. And I do still long form interviews on the weekend. So the Mel Kay Show is .com is the hub.
Highly recommended. And all of those links will be in the description box down below and as a pinned comment as well. Alexander, Mel, the floor is yours.
Indeed, let's go straight in, because Mel has indeed written a book. And it is an extremely important book. It is one that everyone should read. And it is about what she says is the key decade in modern American life, which is the decade which ultimately has shaped everything and shapes the events of today. And it is a decade, basically the decade from the end of the Second World War going forward. But I will leave her to discuss that in more detail. What I will say is this. This is, as far as people in Europe are concerned, the moment of peak America. It is when the United States has essentially a nuclear weapons monopoly for much of that decade. It has by far the world's biggest economy, much bigger in manufacturing terms than, say, China's is today. Just to say, I mean, US manufacturing, about 60% of the world's production in the mid-1940s. It had all the world's gold reserves. The standard of living in the United States was higher than that of any society in human history up to that time. US technology was at its greatest lead. And the US political system seemed impregnably strong and stable. And yet Mel tells us that this is when the actual problems began. So tell us about this problems, Mel.
Okay, well, the book is based on JFK's 1961 speech. You know, I was traveling the country during the last 4 years, and I'd often start with JFK's speech. And of course, that's the speech to the press in 1961, when he said that there was a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that was inside America, and that it was infiltration instead of invasion, subversion instead of elections, intimidation instead of free choice, and guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. And I knew this by heart. And I would always think, well, what exactly was JFK looking at when he wrote this speech? A lot of people would say communism, but just like terror and global warming, all of these are buzzwords for essentially, I think, the endless war for profit model that was built between World War I and World War II, essentially when they created the BIS, you know, for reparations. That is not what the BIS became, nor should the BIS still exist, because at Bretton Woods, they voted to end the BIS. And of course, they ignored that completely. So to me, what it's really about here is that the American people particularly, but people of all nations, were convinced after World War II that the Allies had won and the world was safe, you know, and all of that. When really what was going on was that, I believe, two brothers, two lawyers from Wall Street that were in Switzerland much of World War II, creating with the Bank of England and the Reich Bank and the banks of the City of London, a global supranational architecture that would be have continuity and sustainability above all nations, above any president, and way above the people. And then at the same time, also put the people, the citizens, particularly of the United States, on the hook for paying for it all. And that also was solidified with both the 47 Act that created the CIA, which I don't believe was created to protect America. Rather, I think the Dulles brothers, particularly, created the CIA and the Five Eyes Nations apparatus and their partners at MI6 to essentially be an international intelligence organization that was protecting the international banking cartel and the global public-private partnership, of course, of endless wars for profit from the people of the United States of America and all other nations. So I went through all the documents leading up to that speech of JFK that I could possibly find to pinpoint exactly what he meant. And I believe that I have exposed that architecture that is still functioning today. I believe that architecture was turned on the United States of America in 2016. And I think that it can empower all people in our nations, particularly in Europe and the United States, to understand that we were not only betrayed, but deceived. And that education and NGOs and all of the people that gave themselves immunity in the International Organization Immunity Act of 1945 that is inexplicably still in place to this day is the key to all of this. Not only did they create international bankers and lawyers, a supranational architecture above all nations, but I think they also not only gave themselves immunity, but then again, with the CIA, they give themselves complete opacity. So the American citizens are paying trillions of dollars between the Cold War, the War on Terror, the global climate, which is really a global citizenship model, for a long-planned one-world government run by, I believe, a unified Europe without Russia, if you look at the Third Reich and what's going on now, run by Brussels and Geneva with the Bank of England and or the City of London, the Vatican, and unfortunately, Wall Street and DC as the partners. And that's what I believe. And the Dulles brothers are key. In 1953, the two Dulles brothers walked into the two highest positions in the United States of America after spending about 15 years creating that architecture. That would be John Foster Dulles, the State Department Secretary of State, and his brother, Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. And they both come from Sullivan and Cromwell, which is a Wall Street bank that created essentially the model of multinational corporations of which we still live under today.
I think you're absolutely correct about the fact that this is the period when the architecture of the modern world was created. People, I think, don't realize how profoundly different the world was before and after this time. And your book actually starts, importantly, with 1944. So the Second World War isn't yet over. Right. And I think the key events that take place during this time is, firstly, in the summer of 1944, you have the meeting in Bretton Woods, when the financial architecture of the modern world is created and the financial institutions, the International Monetary Fund, first and foremost, but then you have also eventually the World Bank, but that is created too. There is the leveraging, in effect, of US gold reserves to create this system, which is going to be a global system. So all currencies are now linked and integrated with each other in ways that had never happened before. So currencies are linked to the dollar. The dollar is linked to gold. The dollar, in theory, is at the center. But you have now a system where the Federal Reserve Board is no longer administering the dollar in specifically American interests. For the domestic economy. It is now being used as the currency that is the linchpin of the global economy as well. So the dollar changes. It changes profoundly. And contrary to what many people think, the events of 1971, when the dollar becomes a fiat currency entirely, is, in my opinion, actually prefigured by what happened in 1944. And then, of course, in the lead up to towards the end of 1944, you have the preparations for the summit meeting of the three powers in Yalta, which sets up the United Nations, which also is a supranational body. And then you have the further meeting in Potsdam, which is, by the way, to a degree that is not understood, an extension of Yalta. And all of this, as you absolutely rightly say, while the Dulles brothers are busy in Switzerland meeting with the Germans and having all sorts of interesting discussions with all kinds of people. So 1944 is the key year. But tell us what happens after. Tell us what happens in 1947.
Okay, well, first, in 1944, we have to remember is the D class is on my website, and anyone can see it, is the Red House meeting that happened in Strasbourg with all the bankers. But Himmler was very involved in that, too. And Schreff from the Nazi Reich Bank, and also Montagu Norman from the Bank of England, but then also a lot of the multinational corporation leaders, like from IG Farben and many of the companies that had one foot in America and one foot in Germany, particularly were represented by Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell is essentially what I believe the law firm that created the entire architecture we're talking about through what we still deal with today, lawfare to a certain extent, and manipulating legal language to protect themselves. But the big move, which you are talking about, is the 1947 defense document or national document that created the CIA, the NSA, the Department of Defense, and two other tentacles of that. And it is my belief, after looking through thousands of pieces of information, that that was not created, the CIA, to protect the United States of America. I firmly believe the CIA, because also at the same time, remember, the Five Eyes Nations was formed as well. I believe that the Five Eyes Nations agreement with the CIA was really an international intelligence operation protecting the international banking cartel and the global public-private partnership that was created at Bretton Woods, but also, as you said, with the United Nations. We can't forget that they already tried. And listen, going into World War I is sketchy as well. And we all know about Smedley Butler coming out after World War I and essentially saying all wars are bankers' wars, that war is a racket, that this is a war for profit model all the way back in World War I. Then those years in between World War I and World War II, when two different committees, the Dawes and Young's Committee, create the Bank of International Settlements for reparations. But almost immediately, it is the Reich Bank at the table. We got the City of London bankers at the table. We got the Bank of England. We got American banks, particularly J.P. Morgan at the time. And they are all realizing that essentially this model was probably going to be their best shot, since the League of Nations was explicitly a one world government and rejected by the American people, that they could then reconfigure and say that the United Nations was now something different. Well, it wasn't something different. It is still the same group of people. And never forget, the people we're talking about between 44 and 54 that created this are essentially the same family or bloodlines that also came in with the treasonous Wilson administration in America that created the Federal Reserve. And of course, the Federal Reserve has never been federal nor a reserve. And also the IRS, so just get the U.S. taxpayer, you know, on the dole for the next 60 years of paying for all of these adventures of the supranational crew. And then at the same time, you put in that now the CIA, 2 years later, gives themselves complete and total opacity. So the American taxpayers, to the tune of, we have no idea, because the CIA doesn't have to tell anyone, essentially, including the president, what they're doing, how much money is going towards it, or what the operations are about. But now, if you pull back the curtain, you're going to see that there was a lot of preparations for a World War III before Hitler surrendered. And the Red House papers, and if you go back to that, seems to have been a money laundering operation to get as much money that was looted, laundered, stolen, and pillaged from 60 million people that were affected by World War II out of Nazi Germany. Through, it looks like to me, the Vatican Bank and the City of London into, like, essentially the United States of America by creating subsidiaries of German industrial companies in the United States and transferring the money all out of Germany before Hitler had the go-ahead to surrender. So when you look at all of this and then you read the Red House papers and what the industrialists that had one foot in Germany and one foot in America and their lawyers were saying was, we're going to let Germany fall for now, but we are not giving up on this totalitarian plan, which is essentially what the Nazis' ideology is, and with eugenics bent. And I believe that much of that money was laundered all over the world to sit in waiting. And then if you continue to look at what Alan Dulles was doing in Germany, and then another man from America, McCloy, comes in to be the reconstruction guy in Germany. Well, Alan Dulles, suddenly they turn the entire model on Russia. And I'm not saying that Russia is innocent, but I am saying that they were allies during Nazi Germany. It's very unclear what happens right there. With all of that, but the Dulles brothers were extraordinarily involved. And what did they do? Alan Dulles not only made sure that none of the SS and the very, like, the worst of the worst Nazis in Ukraine were never held accountable, were not included in Nuremberg and all of that, but then he swallows in Galen and the heads of the Nazi SS, essentially FBI, into the CIA as well. And again, we have to know that Dulles put the head of the Nazi intelligence in charge of West Germany and then swallowed a lot in. And of course, the next things we're knowing about, Operation Paperclip, right? Well, they have to get all the best Nazi scientists. And again, these aren't just, you know, Wernher von Braun and all the guys that went to the Jet Propulsion Lab and all of that. They also brought over thousands of people that were professors in Nazi Germany. They brought in people, they created the whole behavioral science, and they put all of those people into our universities and our institutions. So the infiltration was pretty quick and very obvious. And I believe that, and like I said, the fact that they gave themselves all immunity from investigation, audit, even going on the grounds from the BIS and all 63 banks, including the IMF and the World Bank. And then they give the same immunity in 45 to the UN and 76 tentacles of the UN. Why are they protecting themselves so much if they're not doing something that needs to be protected? And it's not protected for us. It's protected from us. No. And no president since has mentioned this at all. We have the IMF and World Bank and UN on the soil of the United States of America, and the United States of America has zero jurisdiction over any of these entities, even on our soil. I mean, it's insanity. And if we're sovereign, how is that possible?
Indeed. I don't think many people really know, in fact, that throughout the Second World War, even as the United States and Germany were fighting each other, US and German bankers actually used to meet quite regularly in Switzerland through the BIS institutions. And this is done quite, you know, openly. There was no secret about it. There's nothing illegal, in fact, about it. It was quite extraordinary, actually, that what was going on and the fact that there was these interactions taking place there. We've discussed, as I said, the setting up of these extraordinary institutions, the CIA, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, which is very different from the kind of military structures that the United States historically had and which existed and which was set up by the US Constitution. I mean, after the US Civil War, the US had an enormous military establishment, but it quickly dismantled it. This time, it perpetuated and expanded it. And it had, we went through a system where the US had very simple intelligence agencies into this enormous apparatus of intelligence and counterintelligence and security, which again sits very uncomfortably with the Constitution. And then in 1948, you have NATO, the establishment of NATO. Again, the United States has always avoided alliances. If you go back to George Washington's farewell address, he says that the United States should avoid alliances. And now it is locked into an alliance. And you mentioned Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England. But of course, the British were very happy about NATO.
Yes.
It was basically already the groundwork was prepared with Churchill's Fulton speech. And the first Secretary General of NATO, Lord Isbury, said it very simply. He said it's to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, but the Americans in. So that's basically the structures that we then have. Can you say something about the opposition to all of this, which existed in the United States at that time? Because what I think many people don't know today is that all of the points that we've just been discussing were made at the time in the United States. There was a significant pushback against it. You had people like Senator Taft, for example, in the Senate, who would argue against it. They consistently lose these battles. They're consistently described as isolationists, but they do exist, and they do have quite a lot of support in U.S. society. So can you say something about them too?
Yeah. See, this is where I think that, as you remember, Eisenhower, who was, of course, I think, usurped and deceived by the Dulles brothers. Don't forget, in 1953, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles walked into the two highest positions in the United States that are unelected. After working on this architecture for 20 plus years, they become the head of the Secretary of State, which was John Foster Dulles, and his brother becomes the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles. And from that point on, we do have multiple people, including both Eisenhower and Truman, that come out and denounce this. As you remember, Eisenhower, as he was leaving office, he said that beware of the military-industrial complex and the international banks, that it was the most dangerous thing for the United States, which I believe he was talking about NATO. And also then Truman, who signed the one-page memo that created this international intelligence apparatus, on his deathbed, essentially, in the Washington Post, he wrote an op-ed saying that had he ever known what the CIA would have become, and that it would essentially usurp foreign policy and become, he said, sinister and like a U.S. Gestapo, he never would have created it. So again, and then everyone after, including JFK, Reagan, everyone that questioned this apparatus was taken out, or at least, you know, eliminated to some extent, if not assassinated. So to me, I think that we have to realize the JFK speech that my book is based on was the resistance. And every single person that resisted, and JFK made that speech in 61 because he realized that they were not listening to the people of the United States of America. And he felt that it was his duty to get up there and say it. And this is after he caught them setting up the CIA, the Bay of Pigs, and that it wasn't what he was told and he was being lied to. And this has gone on, believe me, the entire model, because you brought up Montague Norman. Well, another person came on the scene named George Soros in the later years, the 70s and 80s. But what we have to remember is that George Soros was very involved with the Council of Foreign Relations, which I believe the Council of Foreign Relations and Chatham House are the nodes of this entire, you know, situation. And of course, Dulleses were very involved in the Council of Foreign Relations. But John Foster Dulles goes to the World Bank. So you do have to look at where these people are moving on the chessboard. And then, of course, we have Kissinger and Brzezinski become key players in all of this as well. But George Soros, the reason I bring that up is because in 1993, he wrote a document called NATO World Order. And we all know that Gorbachev and Reagan and Baker agreed that they would end NATO because the USSR fell, NATO's supposed to be over. But what you're not knowing is that the international banking cartel at this point, George Soros being a part of it, has already decided the next 30 years of the playbook for themselves. And what happened, I believe, is that the bombing of Yugoslavia that started the entire regime change operation that led to essentially the EU, which I believe to be a capture operation of the international banks, that also, oddly enough, I'm sure it was an accident during the bombing that Clinton did of Yugoslavia, which was totally, I believe, you know, unjustified. They hit accidentally the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia. Okay. And what was the, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Do you want to come into the World Trade Organization? Was the offer after that? I mean, it just, if you look at the pattern and you know that they want a one world control mechanism that they control and that they built between 44 and the you know, years after, and then, you know, you can bring in things after that, but all of that was turned on the United States of America in 2016. Mm. The playbook that had been playing out in Europe to create the unified Europe, like I said, I believe that they were full well using Ukraine before the fall of the USSR to date to be the hub for the World War III. The third try at the unified Europe without Russia and running the world through Brussels and Geneva. And so to me, when I look at it all, and then you just watch and you see that these people didn't care who the president of the United States was. They didn't care who was running anything. They'd like to have people in there that were on their side and knew the plans. But, you know, Trump winning, we have been in the same playbook color revolution that they pulled off in Europe to get to where we are now in Europe on America. And so, again, we have to now look at it like, what is the global architecture that has been running this operation all this time? And I think we can see it now.
Exactly, because this is the point. I mean, the structures that have been created, which are globalist structures, I think you are absolutely correct in what you say. They are globalist structures. They have no particular loyalty to any particular country, because that is contrary to being a globalist. And so ultimately, you know, in order for them to maintain control, they have all of this, all of these structures, all of these institutions that have been created since the Second World War, which are there to serve them. And that is exactly what happens. And if you look at the language, the rhetoric, the talk about, you know, the rules-based international order and all of that language, it basically comes and evolves from that. And the crisis, which is an ongoing crisis that the United States has been in, is to a great extent the result of that, the tension that exists between the America of the Constitution and the America that was created or recreated or reimagined in the 1940s. Mel, this has been a fascinating discussion. Do you have anything, last things to say before we wrap up?
Well, I just want to say that all of our nations have been greatly deceived about the truth about the post-World War II period. Yeah. And don't forget, we have all been inundated with, I believe, subversive NGOs. They've been looking into the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford Foundation since the 30s as subverting the voice, the vote, and the will of the people of the United States. But I would say that that's the people of the entire West. So I think that the people of all of our nations have to realize that we are actually all on the same side. We have been equally betrayed and deceived, lied and looted, and frankly sent our kids to wars that were essentially for profit for these people. And we have to realize right now, the war right now is above our nations. And if we can all see the architecture clearly and take action locally, all of us can have a much better future. But until we break that architecture, I liken it to Trump finally rebuilding the ballroom after 70 years in the White House. If we can break that architecture and rebuild it transparently and honestly and remove the immunities of these banking and international institutions, the future of not just the United States, but of the planet will be far better. And we have a chance right now. And the forces that are fighting amongst us within our nations are all being paid for by the same people that built the architecture. And right now, unfortunately, Agenda 2030 and all of their one world government stuff is still on track because the people of our nations are not acknowledging that we have been usurped. And once we do, the righteous indignation of patriots of all of our countries, I believe, can unify far better than anything we have ever seen before.
Resounding words, if I may say, and very true ones. Do you have a copy of your book there, baby?
Yes, I do. It is here. It is called Infiltration Instead of Invasion: America Betrayed 1944 to 1954. All of the bibliography is on the MelKayShow.com resource page, so you can look at all the documents and your eyes will pop out of your head like mine, being like, oh my God, how'd they get away with this? Well, Not anymore. So we got to all be in on exposing this wherever we are. And themelkayshow.com is my hub. And you can get the book anywhere, including Amazon, bookstores. And it's going to be one of four in a series. So I'm excited for the next one. I'm halfway through it. That'll be basically a lot of that will be about Ukraine. And I think it'll be very eye-opening as to how Ukraine fits into the picture of that period as well.
Thank you very much, Mel Kay. Let's have you again. Thank you.
Love you guys. Thank you so much. Bye. Appreciate it. Bye.